We're rolling.
Who's rolling?
We're rolling.
We're rolling. Rolling.
Well, what a pleasure, Brad, to be back. Back at home in the home studio. This is my new podcast voice. How do you like it?
I like it. I'd like to see how long you can stick with it.
Now I'm going to be out of character in no time. Here it is. Brad, it's been so long. I have big news. We have something we need to talk about.
Something, is it serious?
Well, it depends who you ask. If you tell somebody like Brad here, you're not going to get much of a response from his cold, dead heart. If you ask like 95% of other people, they're a little moved by this story. So
I don't think so. I think
okay. Maybe judging by
our patrons in the fairly recent discourse, there was not a lot of sympathy for what you're about to describe.
Well, I know Neil, of course, did not care. Like this is obvious, but. I've told a lot of people this story. So let's do a little backstory here. For years, when I first moved out to the forest here, a couple of geese started coming around right when we moved here. You know, it's a typical thing for city slickers new to this environment. You're like, wow, look at anything that's not a road, a building, a loud noise, and just be totally enamored by it. These geese happened to that same season, put a nest right by our house, which subsequently led to goslings. The children and us, we watched goslings grow. And it was kind of a magical thing. Now, as the years have gone on, the geese have, let's say, become a bit of a problem. As we've talked about on the Chuck Reagan episode, where he informed me on how he gets rid of geese, which is shooting them and making jerky, which, as you know, I'm not capable of doing. What I was capable of doing was throwing ice at their butts and sometimes pine cones and ushering them back to an area that was appropriate because, let's be honest, the geese got a little shitty, okay? They got a little territorial. They started, you know, coming up on the deck, taking a shit every once in a while, running up to the roof. I would just look up and there'd be a couple of them on top of the roof. And they were clearly like fucking with me, you know, at this point. And they're really trying to mark their territory. They come back year after year now. And to say I've had a contentious relationship with them is an understatement. It's been a joke and a long running thing to the point that the going off track Patreons and Karina have made a needle point honor of the geese.
Yeah.
So about 2 weeks ago, there's like a wind and rain storm. Oh, I should also say they're named Ian and Angela. We named them after Ian Perkins and Angela, who live up in Toronto. And they're the Canadian people we know and a beautiful Canadian couple, mates for life, just like the geese, Brad. You cold-hearted bastard. Just like the geese. Mates for life. Okay.
Yeah, don't forget that point.
So Ian and Angela up in Toronto, and we name them this. And about 2 weeks ago, you know, I got a bunch of these dead ash trees in my property. We have a rainy, windy night. And there goes one of the big boys, you know, like right into the water, cracks a part of this little old bridge. Really, really big piece. I'm going to say like probably upwards of 40 to 50 feet of tree that fell. Mm. Now, the next morning, what do I see laying next to the giant branch but a dead goose? I'm not certain if it was Ian or Angela. I've never been able to tell them. Floating in the water, and to top it off, the other one circling around, squawking, you know, really like I'm imagining a movie, Manchester by the Sea. I'm imagining this goose on its knees, you know, like, no, ah, fuck you, ash tree. You know, that's what I'm picturing. And then, of course, since I'm the person I am, I wonder, what if I was nicer to him? What if I didn't throw those pine cones? Would they have been sitting there somewhere else? Would they have felt more welcome, you know? And I was riddled with guilt. And for 2 days, you know, people are saying, Al, you should, you know, go fish it out and have a proper burial. I'm like, well, that's ridiculous to go grab a goose from there. And also I'm like, I'm an actual hippie. I believe in nature. You know what I mean? Like, right. This thing's going to go to the bottom. The fish are going to eat. The turtles are going to eat. The tadpoles are going to eat. Yeah. And that's where this goose should go, right? To me. But eventually, it literally takes fucking 2 days for this body to sink, Brad. Floating goose. Just reminding me for 2 days about the precarious nature of life. With this other goose circling around, squawking, wondering what's going on, you know? And what happens when I tell Brad? Should I tell the people your exact commentary? Because it's pretty funny.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm not ashamed.
Do you mind? All right, we're going back to it.
They're nasty. They just dispense poop like it's a fucking...
Here it is. Okay. I say, Brad, I've got news. An ash tree fell in the pond last night and killed a goose. I get back, OMG, that's amazing. And I'm like... The other one is swimming around squawking. It's a pretty brutal scene. You know, this is an attempt to tug at your heartstrings now, you know, clearly. And yeah, that didn't work because I get back, oh dear, you're going to have to euthanize the mate. Even trees hate geese. Do you follow Nature's Metal on Instagram? Sounds like a horrible cleanup situation for you. You know, you got to take pictures for Patreon and it's Thursday, winky face. Hey, Brad, you know, as adult men here, like, you know, I don't have that many people to talk to, you know? Like I thought the point of us being punk rockers was, you know, the ability to connect on a level, you know? The replacement for the bar stool. Come on, man, you know? But I got to be honest, I will come around as I'm playing myself as the sap here. About 2 days later... I do have this one thought that I can't get out of my head, which is, you know what? The same reason I didn't like you very much is kind of the same reason you're not here. Kind of fucking stupid. This is a giant tree. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I'm a human. I can hear it crack. I just can't imagine how many other animals wouldn't have been able to get out of the way of this thing. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Like... And that's one thing I have learned out here is like, I'm a 30-year vegetarian. I love animals. I'll support animal rights. But one thing I do understand is why deer and geese have become nature's food to a point. They're big. They're sometimes clumsy. And they're not that bright. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I do think nature maybe provided other species with food. Seems like it, right? I choose to abstain from this food.
Eat the dumb. We should follow that rule.
If I was a bear, who would I be going after? I'd be going right after a deer. That long leggy deer, you know? Getting my bear teeth into that back hind. Mm.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the goose. I've been waiting how long to tell it? 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. Did I tell it adequately with enough gusto?
Yeah, I think it was... It's a beautiful story.
That's good. Now, to get to our actual interview here, which was great, by the way. Like, you know, I talked about it a little on the Patreon. I was offered a couple things recently that I was a little reticent about. And I was offered this interview and I was like, oh, how cool. You know what I mean? Just somebody with a wealth of experience on every side of this industry, you know? Like to an extreme. To the point when you're like, you know, attached to Crass and Crass Records and anarcho-punk to having literally just like a smash single. You know, he's seen the extent of the music business as much as like I think you can even possibly see, right? So I was so stoked to do this interview and just find out like where the journey has gone over all these years, you know? Like, I don't know. I thought it was fascinating, especially that stuff back in the day. Like, you know, I was trying to really get him to paint a picture of growing up, you know, in the 70s where he grew up and the punk scene in the 80s and what it looked like, you know, like us Americans, we mythologize it, right?
The brutality of early punk rock.
Yeah. Just the way we see it. I mean, it's like in my head, it's all, you know, just looks like some bad version of like a Sid Vicious documentary or something like it, or, you know, it's just ridiculous. Like, or just mods and these people fighting. But then you find out a lot of it is actually true.
Oh yeah.
You know? And, yeah, that was a really, really interesting part about this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You got to check out the new record and everything that he's working on because it's really interesting stuff. It's done in a way that's taking, you know, some, like we talked about in the interview, just taking some of the most serious stuff you can talk about, some of the most heart-pressing stuff, but conveying in a way that makes it fun and sometimes easy to listen to. And the musicianship and all that is still clearly there, you know? And like these records are cool. I'm glad that I had a chance to do this interview because it gave me a chance to kind of peruse this catalog more than I probably normally would have. And I quite enjoyed it, I must say.
It's going off track!
So let us know again where we're talking to you from.
So I'm in Twisp, T-W-I-S-P, which is a small mountain town in north central Washington, like 45 miles from the border with Canada.
Yeah, I was just reading about that place. I know that you went basically straight from England to there, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, a lot of people, I think, if they don't know Washington, they consider Washington maybe like a... Oh, you know, that's, what is that, a liberal enclave or something. But 4 hours east, you know, in Washington, I know is a completely different story. So, I mean, like, was there any kind of culture shock with some of the stuff you ran into when you moved out there? Or were you kind of well prepared for it?
Yeah, mostly the shock was moving, because I'd always lived in big towns or cities in England. So the shock was going from... Right. City to rural more than, you know.
Why'd you do it?
So my partner, she went to Evergreen College in Olympia. She's from Delaware, and a lot of Evergreen people live out. So we have a real mixture.
That's the most Washington name for a college I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's a, you know, like Bikini Kill came out of Evergreen. Okay. And it's like a radical college.
Oh, that was that scene out there.
Yeah. So people from there and other folks moved out to be organic farmers and fish biologists.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a mixture of like an art community and just what you would expect otherwise in a rural community, you know, the whole spectrum, really, from left-wing to right-wing Christian nationalist. So it's kind of interesting.
It is. I mean, I find getting older, too, I'm kind of in some similar path as you, that, like, the more and more committed you become to true, you know, let's say alternative living as far as your lifestyle goes, like, sometimes that brings you closer and closer to the other side, let's say, you know, yeah, like geographically.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I used to live in the city, you know, there was far less exposure to that, but then also like far less adherence to kind of the shit people were sort of espousing. So like, it's sort of funny how that circle kind of comes to the similar point in the other side, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, because I mean, one of the things I didn't know about coming from England was like wildfires. And we get really bad wildfires and smoke here. And that is a time when, you know, we've had a couple of fires, 2014, 2015. The 2015 one, it came right by the house and everything, and we evacuated and went back to save the house.
Wow.
Etc. But in those times, the whole community kind of pulls together.
Right.
And it's just, yeah, in that emergency situation, it just makes sense to work together. But then, you know, I've taught in the high school local ed theatre. And of course, doing theatre, we run up against parents who don't agree with the subject material and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
So you get both sides of it.
I was going to ask if they grow a lot of weed out there.
You know, when we first moved here, it was before it was legal, people grew it discreetly, and
right,
the cops would, you know, they'd clear cut some small patch in the woods on the mountains and grow it. And the cops would wait till they harvested it before they busted it, because their next year's budget was dependent on the value of the drugs.
Wow.
So they could have gone in at the beginning, but they wouldn't have got any money. But now it's legal.
Oh, wow.
There's like legal growers here, you know, and there's kind of strict rules about it, but...
Right.
And there's a shop in town, you can just go buy it.
So when you were talking about like people coming together during wildfires and stuff, like what was your specific experience in like 14 and 15? Were you evacuated and then like...
Yeah, both those years, we got evacuated.
Wow, that's scary. And where do you go?
So Laura, my partner, had a art studio in town, so we all kind of hunkered down there. And then we just, you know, like 5 miles from the house, and then a lot of people just left town completely and went to like Wenatchee or Seattle. But we kind of went back that night. No, we went back... the morning, you know, we couldn't sleep. So we just, because we thought the house was going to burn.
Yeah.
So we went back the morning after early and it was still there. And there were a couple of fire guys there and they said, okay, you guys take over. We can be better use elsewhere.
Oh, wow.
And there's like an irrigation ditch and there were just spot fires everywhere, little fires. And we spent all day with like buckets in the ditch.
No shit.
Trying to put these fires, because the power goes out and there's no water.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's all based on electricity.
So you're literally like around the house, like building a perimeter, almost like a underground wall, like a trench.
No, we didn't dig trenches. We just put out the spot fires as best we could, either like with dirt or with water. And they keep coming back, you know.
Oh, wow.
You know, and then that night, a friend, some of the other people who were just down valley. We had like a big potluck because they had a big stove that wasn't electric. And then we go back at night and you can just see the whole valley sides lit up with little spot fires. Really intense compared to anything I'd ever experienced. You know, England doesn't really, I mean, they do a bit now, mostly flooding. They don't have tornadoes or hurricanes or... They're very spared from natural disasters, but it's getting worse now because of climate change. They're feeling it a bit, but mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so I had no experience of anything like that.
Yeah. That's pretty harrowing experience. And you have a family too, right? Or you have kids?
Yeah. So the children would have been like, they were born in 2000, so they'd be like 15. So they helped, you know, put the fires out the day after.
Wow. Crazy experience for them too.
Yeah.
That's really, that's like almost the kids don't grow up in England and it's like, here you go. Like, here's your American experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's toughen you up in the old West with some wildfires.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. But it seems like you've really kind of adapted that community. I mean, I read that you work at like a cinema there and uh-huh. you work in the theater and you perform in town, I saw, and stuff like that. Like,
Yeah.
So it sounds like you really found yourself a pretty cool community out there, huh?
Yeah. And I get, you know, I go play in Seattle and record in Seattle, and I just been to Portland in March and played a show. So, I like going to the city. It can be a hole getting there, but I'm kind of used to that now.
Yeah. You just drive out like every time you go to Seattle?
Yeah.
Is that the closest airport as well?
No. Well, there's one in Wenatchee, which is like 90 miles away. My daughter's used that to go to California when she was in school. But I've never used Wenatchee, but...
Yeah. You know, sometimes I ask this, and I think it's cool specifically where you live. Like, you know, what's like your day-to-day like in it? Because, I mean, you had a record in 19, a record in 20, now a new one coming out now. It seems like you're always constantly creating. What's kind of your day-to-day like in your schedule, and when do you really find the time to do all that with all your other interests?
So I mean, very, very roughly, I kind of work 20 hours and then 20 plus hours just doing my projects. This year it's different because I stepped down from the high school, so I'm not, usually I'd be like super busy at this time because they have a production in May, but I had to have surgery last year, so I just had to stop doing a lot of things.
Oh, okay.
But that's all good now. So I'm just trying to focus on this new record at the moment.
Well, it sounds great. The song, you know, I had sounds great. It's like really cool to listen to the, you know, the chronology of how it's changed sounds and how you're presenting the music you do.
Yeah.
I'd love to like go back a tiny bit though, because I'm, you know, looking into your, you know, the background and you know, the idea of growing up in, you know, what, around in the Leeds area in the 70s and coming up in the, what did that look like? And like, did anything in your childhood start informing the ideas that, you know, something was amiss and kind of led to what you wound up doing?
So I think, you know, partly I'm from a working class family, and my older brother went into like pretty much out of high school being in the trade union movement. You know, and I was just the right age. So I lived in a town called Burnley, which is closer to Manchester.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, I moved to Leeds. So we'd go see, you could get on a bus and go to Manchester, and all the punk bands had come through there. So we'd go see them. And then, like, when I was college age, I moved to Leeds to go to college and dropped out. And that's where Chumbawamba kind of formed. Three of us who'd been in a high school band in Burnley, we all lived in a squatted house in Leeds. So, you know, that, you know, and it was like a recession, Mark, Thatcher and Reagan times.
Yeah. I kind of meant a little earlier even, like, you know, I know like 82 and...
Okay.
Yeah, like I was kind of wondering, you know, what even led you to the punk show, you know, even prior to that? Like it seems, especially during that time, that wasn't like a... you know, a path that was super well-founded yet, you know, like coming from an area like that and what the punk scene was like. And it was, Yeah. So, I mean, what was like kind of your early path into that even?
I don't know. I think it was just partly being in the right place at the right time and partly just being curious. Because prior to that, you know, like my older brother's generation, they'd listen to, you know, what we'd call prog rock bands like Yes and Genesis.
Right.
And I had this kind of fantasy of being in a band, which I didn't take very seriously. And I just thought you had to be classically trained to be in a band.
Yeah, if you're listening to Yes.
And then punk rock comes along and it's like, oh, no, just...
Of course.
You just got to learn three chords on a guitar and write some lyrics.
Yeah.
And so it basically turned me around like 180. It was revolutionary. And, you know, and I've done it ever since. So it totally shifted my life in a direction that I don't know, maybe I would have discovered it some other way, but...
What kind of work did your parents do?
So my mom was a stay-at-home mom for quite a lot of years. I have two brothers. And then my dad was like an engineer, but then he became like a, what they call a work study engineer. He was an electrician originally.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we didn't... Growing up, we just thought, oh, yeah... But they were always in, like, you know, always getting, it was before credit cards, but they were always getting loans from the bank, you know, to, so we could go on vacation or so we could build an extension on the house or whatever, you know, just like a normal, I guess you call them duplex.
Right, right.
So, it's kind of a good, that's a really good question. And what were my early things that might have led me to punk? And I'm not sure I know the answer other than that I was brought up to be kind of open-minded.
Right, right. From the family.
Yeah, yeah. My parent, my dad in particular, just like really, you know, open-minded. They've always voted Labour, you know, the traditional working class party, though they're not really like that anymore. But
right, right, yeah.
And I think just, you know, my friends in high school, we were all kind of fell into it at the same time. And that is probably a key thing, that I had peers who we supported each other, you know.
Right.
So when I guess the initial thing of coming out as a punk rock, and it was basic, you know, I mean, you know, you had to make a choice. Okay, I'm not going to wear flared jeans anymore. I'm going to wear drain pipes.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We all kind of learned to use, I learned to sew.
There's a moment. There's always a moment.
Yeah, yeah. And like, it's okay, we'll take the flares in and turn them into drain pipes on my mum's sewing machine. And it's funny, I still sew, I have a machine still today, but...
That's great. That's exactly how my wife owns a clothing company, and that's how she got into it, being a punk rocker, making their own clothes, right? It's part of the deal.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember, like, you know, it sounds like scene-wise, you know, when you're doing this entry, there was a lot of bands that were starting to come up in that Manchester Leeds area that were interesting to go see. Like, what were the bands and the venues you and your friends were hitting at that time?
So initially in Manchester, I mean, we pretty much saw all the bands apart from the Sex Pistols and maybe Wire, who I would have loved to have seen at that time. But
right.
But like Manchester, you know, Buzzcocks and The Fall, Joy Division, and some of the lesser known Manchester bands, Slaughter and the Dogs and John the Postman. And I guess it was so easy to get there. You know, there was a bus strike one time and we're like, oh crap, we want to go see The Fall. So we cycled, it's like 24 miles. And we weren't cyclists, but we cycled to Manchester and then saw the gig and then cycled.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it took about, I don't know, probably 3 hours to get there, but it took us 6 hours to get back. We were just so exhausted, but it was just an adventure, you know. And then I guess when we moved to Leeds has more of the like goth kind of thing, which wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, but there was a venue, a guy in Leeds, he had a venue called the F Club, John Keenan, and he did these festivals every year, like a 2-day festival. And it was, you know, mostly punk bands. And it was amazing. You know, pretty much any band who was current that year would be on at this festival.
Oh, wow.
So it just seemed like really easy to go see the music we wanted to see because it was so accessible. We did have a friend who had a car. You know, driving cars as a teenager is not as big a deal in Britain as it is here. But you could still get public transport to places or hitchhike. Well, sometimes we'd hitchhike to shows. And
I love that.
So you've just been in the UK.
Yeah. I was just in all those areas. I mean, the closest, I did Manchester and we did Wolverhampton, and I took a trip out that day to Redditch to see the grave of John Bonham and visit the statue in the middle of Redditch.
Oh, yeah.
So, I just had a nice journey into the... I had my family out in London, got them all some fish and chips and did the thing.
Yeah.
So I had my good English experience recently for sure.
Cool.
I mean, you know, in the States, you know, especially at the time you were a burgeoning punk rocker, you know, a lot of the people of that time kind of have stories of, you know, resistance almost from adults, from parents, from, you know, locals who, you know, are aligned with other things. And, you know, punk rock was kind of more of a, you know, a dangerous thing in those days and viewed at in different ways. Like, did you have any real, like, kind of stand your ground, you know, moments where it was challenged like that?
So there's a couple of times, well, probably more than a couple, but yeah, it was, you were, I won't say you had a target on your back, but you suddenly looked different and people were really challenged by that. And of course, you know, the news media owned by Rupert Murdoch would kind of paint punk rockers as an evil to society or whatever. And
right.
And I guess the late 70s, you know, there was kind of like a resurgent mod movement, MOD, and some bands around that. So we once got chased by these mods, you know, they just wanted to fight. We got away because we were faster.
Yeah.
And occasionally we'd be at a show and there'd be fights breaking out. But that was probably more along the lines of, you know, football teams, soccer teams.
right.
Because there's another town, they had a bigger Blackburn, which is like 12 miles from Burnley. And some of the bands had come through it. We went to see the Stranglers and, you know, one of our friends, Nadim, his parents are Indian and... So he's, you know, a brown kid amongst all these white punks. And these Blackburn kids just wanted to attack him, you know, pure racism. So we had to defend him and,
yeah,
you know, that kind of stuff that happens in the scene.
Sure.
And then I guess a little bit later, you know, when we Chumbawamba formed, I guess it was like 84, you know, we were part of the anarcho punk scene by this point. And we did a benefit tour for the coal miners. It was like with Flux of Pink Indians and Björk's first band, Icelandic band, KUKL.
Oh, wow.
And just one of these gigs near Birmingham, you know, skinheads come and basically trash the whole thing. And it's because, you know, the anarcho-punk thing was, it was pacifist. So we're like, oh, we can't fight back. But these skinheads basically put like 4 people in hospital, including the drummer of one of the bands.
Yikes.
And after that, we kind of made a band policy not to tolerate that kind of behavior. And it only ever happened a couple of times after that where, funnily enough, once we were on tour in the U.S., and we were in Memphis.
Oh, yeah.
These kids who call themselves Vegan Reich,
oh,
as in Third Reich. but vegan.
Yeah, I remember this.
And they started causing trouble, you know, during whilst we were playing. And we basically jumped off stage and threw them out. And the whole audience applauded, you know, because this kid had been kind of terrorizing people, you know, and nobody had stood up to him. So you kind of live and learn as you go. You learn how to deal with these things.
And that's an interesting lesson, too. I think a lot of, I don't know, like punks have to deal with. Like, do you, you know, with all that experience in tow in that way, I'm curious, like, because I kind of go back and forth with the same philosophy. I'm like, am I a pacifist? Does it actually work? Like, in totality, does it actually work? Like, you know, how much to you do you think, you know, like direct action and sometimes, you know, kind of hands-on stuff is necessary to advance your cause?
I think so, yeah. I'd say I'm, you know, 95% pacifist. And it's only in those times where if you don't, you know, and I'm not into like going out and searching people out, but if you know, say there were fascists who were causing shit and, you know, potentially harming people, then I do believe you can physically, if there's enough of you or you're organized enough, put yourselves in the way and stop them physically.
Yeah.
If necessary.
Right.
You know, and you can extend that if I lived in Ukraine, for instance, or if I'd been a teenager during World War II, would I have joined the army? I don't know. Probably. I don't know.
Yeah. Like we talked about before, I mean, you had Chimp Eats Banana, and then, you know, that eventually turned into, you know, the earliest incarnation of Chumbawamba. And then, you know, like you said, you form in 82, the year Thatcher decides to invade Argentina. And like, this seems, you know, I almost know a lot of this, you know, as an American, almost by like parody, like by Fred Armisen, like parodying this stuff.
And, oh.
like what I know about, you know, like the Sex Pistols and, you know, it's not as, but this seems like such a, like, is this really the pivotal point that it seems from someone from my perspective in like the English punk movement?
So, I think, you know, Thatcher in general, but certainly for us, you know, the Falklands War, I guess Chumbawamba, we'd played like probably like three or four gigs in 1982, which was when the first gig was in January. I think the Falklands War started in April. And that really kind of politicized us. And then everything else Thatcher did, you know, like, and I'd say the second and probably more important, in 1984, there was a huge coal miner strike which lasted 18 months. And basically Thatcher just wanted to destroy the trade unions. And she, in the end, kind of did, you know, I mean, she humbled. But like, we were part of a support group supporting the miners, you know, initially playing benefit gigs and then collecting money on the streets. And then being invited to a picket line. Actually, the song, you know, off the new album, When Push Comes to Shove, is inspired by that experience.
Right.
In that, you know, we went to this picket line and there were thousands of supporters and the miners and probably thousands of riot police. And we're on opposite sides of the road and it's like 5 a.m. in the morning.
Wow.
When they bring in the non-unionized labor in these buses, and it's before cell phones. And so they have runners telling, you know, running down the road, okay, the buses are coming.
Wow.
So, right, we push against the cops.
Oh, it's like a movie.
Yeah, it was a physical push and shove to block the road to stop the buses getting in. And we did for, you know, but it was just one day out of 18 months or... They'd have these probably like once a month where they had so many people that they could actually block the road. And you can't do that. You certainly couldn't do that in this country because the cops have guns.
Yeah.
And they do in the UK now to a lesser extent. But that metaphor of, you know, pushing from below is, and also with the current wave of, you know, people trying to unionize, you know, Starbucks or Amazon. And I just think it's a more hopeful time because we've had so much since Thatcher and Reagan. Basically, they declared a class war from above, you know, on behalf of the elite classes and corporations. And we've been fighting that ever since. And it's getting to a point, especially with climate change, where something is going to break, you know, probably in our lifetimes. So I see things getting worse, but I also see some hope. And I think, you know, having lived through since Thatcher and Reagan and everything in between, maybe I have something to offer, you know, in terms of what I do, which is mostly punk attitude, not necessarily the sound, if you want to define it by sound, in the music I try and put out.
Yeah. I think it's really nice to, you know, to hear hope, honestly, and to hear like the idea that from someone who's been experiencing it, you know, for a long time, that, you know, you're not looking at it going, Jesus Christ, like, this was useless or something like that. Cause that would be, I think, you know, people have this weird idea that hope is like not punk.
Yeah.
But if you're like bereft of hope, like you're no longer, you know, looking at the future, and looking at the idea that you can change it if you're not. So you have to like, gotta hold on to that. Right. You know?
I think so. Yeah. And it's, you know, I tend to read more nonfiction these days, you know, and some of that's history. And you can think, yeah, it's desperate and there's nothing I can do. Or you can think, which is kind of what I do more these days, is that, well, if I don't express dissent, then they've won already.
Mm.
There's no other choice than to try and express dissent and bring about change. And if you look through history, the big changes have happened because people have just persevered over, sometimes over decades. And as an older person, the decades since the 80s, I can see that it's not something that's solved overnight. You just got to keep plugging away.
Do you think it's like your experience, you know, you grow up working class and you kind of go along this pipe and the punk rock pipe and wind up, you know, in the kind of, to a point, at one point in your career, wind up in the, you know, sort of the mainstream kind of scenario. Do you think it taught you even more about how fucked up, you know, the capitalist type stuff can be by being able to like see it from the inside out for a while?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It was just an insane combination of factors that brought us to that point. You know, the record company we were with were having financial problems. We were trying to finish an album. You know, somebody, our managers were putting out the CD of the album inside the industry, you know, to people who might want to sign us or whatever. And that particular song suddenly took on a life of its own. And we didn't even get it at the time. And suddenly we had like major record labels chasing us. And we're like, this didn't make sense. But, you know, and we had long, long band meetings about whether we should sign with a major. And eventually we decided, well, we'll do it. We'll probably last a year. And we'll have a really good time while we're doing it. And we did, and it lasted a bit more longer than a year. But you kind of learn. I mean, it was before streaming, and I think Napster hadn't quite come out by then, or it was just kind of a new thing. And so it was still the old model of, you know, put out CDs, do a tour. And like, you know, in the mainstream, it's like, oh, well, it's better to go to a radio station or be on a TV show because, you know, we were on that David Letterman, and the record company guy comes the week after and he goes, look, this is how many albums you've sold, 176,000 in the last week.
Wow.
Because you were on the TV show, which was more than we'd sold all the albums in our entire career up to that point.
Wow.
And you kind of learn, and we were older, we were in our early 30s, so you kind of see, we did this gig, I suppose you'd call it a gig, it was at Knott's Berry Farm, which we didn't really know what Knott's Berry Farm was. It was like a summer festival, and we were on with that band, Hanson, I don't know if you remember them.
Oh, of course.
They were like three teenage brothers.
Yeah.
Mbop was the song. Mm-hmm. And they had a tour manager, and they were just kind of like functionaries of this operation, you know, that was a money-making operation. And they loved doing music, but they were just sucked into this machine and they had no control over what they were doing. And it was really sad to see. And so I guess we learnt it because, you know, we had that song and then they put out the second single and it kind of registers, but not really. And the third single just disappears and we couldn't compete against ourselves. So at some point, the record company decided, okay, just foot down on the accelerator on the one song. And that is how you become a one-hit wonder because they see that's where the money is. They're not going to make the money kind of investing in us as a long-term prospect. And I guess in some ways, you know, from their point of view, it pays off because, you know, right. That song still gets, we still get royalties from that song. Like 98% of the royalties we've ever got are from that one song.
Wow.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So going back to Tub Thumb, what was the actual like songwriting process for that song? Like what was the seed for that song and how did it develop into what it actually was? It's a pretty epic tune.
Yeah. So that, you know, when we did an album, we'd always kind of have a couple of meetings before kind of to come up with like a general theme. And, you know, the general theme for that album, Tub Thumper, the album, was kind of like Leeds working class stories.
Mm.
And the actual story of that song, you know, the lyric story, we had the tune and, you know, we could tell when we were rehearsing tunes, okay, this would be a really good song to play live because it's kind of upbeat and, you know, it just needs, you know, we'd have like nonsense words and then we'd always kind of write proper words. And the guitar player, Boff, you know, he lived in a row house and he was in bed with his wife one night and they could hear a drunk guy coming up the street singing Danny Boy. And he happened to be the next door neighbor. And so he was like making all this noise and he was trying to put his key in the front door and he fell over and then he got up again and then he did it again. And that's where it comes from. And it's just something we've probably all done.
Yeah, been there.
And it just has universal appeal.
Sure.
And it, when we put that in the chorus, it suddenly just fit perfectly with the music, and that's kind of the story of it.
What, like, I mean, even music wise, like, how was a Chumbawamba song created? Like, did you start at a riff? Did you start at a melody? I know, you know, a little later in your career, you even had a little more leaning into like dance music and stuff like that. Like, what was the ground up process of one of your songs?
So it was, I think we were different in that we didn't really sit around and jam. We never did that. We tried it one time and we like rented a farmhouse for like 5 days and just to try and go write songs in a different way.
Yeah, it's a fruitless task.
Yeah, we came up with two songs, which were, they ended up being good songs, but it was more, we, like I said, we'd have ideas and themes. And people would have different skills. So I was one of the lyric writers. So we'd go away and write lyrics and then like the drummer and the guitar player would come up with ideas for tunes or basic rhythms and beats. And then we'd come, they, you know, we'd submit the lyrics and they'd see if they fit or they'd get changed so they did fit. So it was kind of a weird process in some ways. It wasn't like we were all there at the same time. We would all come together. When we had a kind of, you know, a basic version, you know, with a tune and some lyrics, then we'd all come together and rehearse and it would evolve from there.
That's interesting. How often is that song like requested for things? I have to imagine you're getting a lot of requests for any number of things with that song. Like, how, you know, what's the policy? Like who determines what and what's going to happen with like the future of that tune?
So we've always maintained control. They, you know, they have to get permission from the band for anyone to use it. And, you know, there's 8 people in the band. So, and I did it for a while when I was in England. We would have 2 or 3 of us who would kind of go through the requests. And then if it was like contentious or potentially contentious, we'd ask the rest of the band, but usually it was an easy decision, you know, and like, you know, films or somebody wants to use it for a college project, you know, fine. The only contentious ones are is advertising.
Right.
Which initially we thought, no, we'd never do it. And then somebody said, oh, well, look, if we were on tour in Italy. I think it was the first time we'd ever got a request from and it was Fiat, the car company. And they said, right, we're going to give you $20,000 to use the song in an advert in Italy. We're like, no way. And then somebody said, well, maybe we should do it and give the money away. And so we were playing at this squat venue, which we'd played at before, and they had a pirate radio. And this all happened in the same night. And so we said, look, if we did this advert, this is to the pirate radio people, and we gave you the money, would you accept it, these anarcho-communist Italian squatters? And they're going, yeah, we'd accept it. It'd keep us going for like 10 years. So we decided to do it. So we did that for a few years, but it kind of relies, because, you know, the publishing money is like a year behind.
Right.
And so for it to work, we had to have the money in the bank to be able to give it away. And we could do that for a while. And then, you know, as the money kind of got less or the publishing deals got less, we couldn't really maintain that without without getting into, you know, overstepping financially. Mm-hmm. But it was cool. We did it, you know, and I don't know many other bands who've ever been able to do that. So it felt good to be able to do that. And I mean, since then, we've taken money from advertising and, you know, lived off it, basically, which...
Yeah.
I have some wrinkles about, but I also know that, you know, like, for instance, my new album is paid for by royalties from that one song, some of which come from advertising, you know, and it's an anti-corporate record, but it's, we still have corporate publishing company who collect the money on our behalf and take their cut. But, it, you know, if you worked in a factory or whatever, you're working for a corporation and, you know, if you're in a punk band, say, oh, you've sold out, blah, 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 but we're entrapped, all of us, I mean, we're entrapped in a system where probably at some point most of us will work for a corporation in our lives. And most of the time you don't ever get the chance to criticize that corporation or that model. So it, in some ways it's a compromise, but in some ways it allows me and the rest of the people in the band the luxury of being able to continue to make art, you know, because we live pretty cheap. So we can still put things out there.
Yeah.
And not have to work in a factory, you know, an assembly line, or if people still do that these days, if it's not robots, but you know what I'm saying?
I do. I think it's really interesting. I mean, I went through something similar with, you know, when early on I was, and I still am, you know, very cautious of this stuff, but, you know, when I was really reticent to sign to a major label, and I'm at some festival one day and I'm playing a show and I think I still have my punk rock cred, and then I look out and see that the whole thing is sponsored by Jägermeister and Budweiser and Heineken, and I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like this already happened. I don't know when it happened, but it did.
Yeah.
And you know, I know a lot of your aspirations, especially early on, were, you know, potentially taking this platform and using it for change. Using it to enhance a voice. And like you said, now that the dust is settled, it's been able to support a whole bunch of people doing artistic and interesting and potentially, you know, like, you know, politically leaning stuff for the rest of their life. And it kind of gave you license to do that. So, you know, I can see it being morally scrupulous, but in the end, I guess the question is, like, did it work? You know, do you think this was the best path for making what you all wanted to say as effective as possible?
I think it did in a lot of ways. You know, there are probably things we've done which we might do differently, but it's interesting because we had, you know, we come from that punk scene. We played shows with Fugazi and a Dutch band, The X, both of whom remained staunchly independent. So when we met up with them after we'd had the big song, we had, you know, they were fascinated by our choice to do that and how it affected us. And they weren't necessarily critical. They said, look, I couldn't do that, but I appreciate that you've gone through it. And it's just super interesting to see how it did work or how it didn't work. And, you know, I think in the end, and I think we knew this from the beginning, we couldn't win against that machine, you know, but whilst we were in that bubble, and it is a bubble, the mainstream bubble, you know, we got on platforms we would never have been on, and we made a point of making statements or taking actions in the full public glare of the mainstream media kind of bubble, and putting an opinion out there or a voice that you never see in that setting. And it means that you burn your bridges very quickly. It's funny, I one of my jobs for the band was being the archivist. So I have all the press clippings, which is, I don't know, 20 boxes of stuff. And occasionally, you know, I shipped them when I moved here and they've stayed in boxes. And occasionally someone say, oh, so-and-so needs to know this detail about this. And when the guys who were doing the shipping, I had it all filed. They just threw them into boxes. So it all got mixed up. But last year, like I said, I had surgery. So I had all this time off and I had to find this detail. So I put it all chronologically again. And my daughter helped me, who was helping look after me.
Oh, cool.
And I realized in a period of 3 months, we were on David Letterman, Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. And we did the Brit Awards, which are the equivalent of the Grammys. You know, and we made a statement on David Letterman, which meant that we were banned from being on there ever again. On Politically Incorrect, Alice, you know, it'd been in the press that we'd said, if you can't afford the albums, we don't mind if you shoplift them from Virgin. And they took Bill Maher and the other people, guests, were really offended by this idea that, you know, oh, well, you're criticizing capitalism, basically.
And right, right, right.
That is the one thing that they don't want in the mainstream. Whether you're on an economics program or you're an artist or a musician, there's very, especially in America, but it's similar in Britain, there is very little open criticism of capitalism in the mainstream media. And partly that's what this new record's about, the idea that in America we have this market fundamentalism, which is basically burning the planet down, but you're not supposed to question it because what else is there? Mm-hmm. And there's no alternatives put forward in the mainstream. There's lots of alternatives, you know, at a grassroots level or underground level or, you know, all the protest groups in all the different areas you could imagine who normally don't get any access to the mainstream. So, you know, it was, for us, it was a lesson in that you can, you know, go out shouting, really, because you're not going to last very long. That you just don't get invited back to the party. And that is why I think so many bands who maybe one respected or thought were good, once they get in that situation, and especially once the money starts coming, to stay in that bubble, you just got to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to play the game.
Right. To the point, and this is a story, I want to hear this from your perspective. Like, you didn't want to play the game to the point that you poured a jug of water over the UK Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what the fuck happened? Because that sounds amazing. Okay.
So that was the Brit Awards. And we had just done a huge benefit. The Liverpool dock workers were on strike. And we did a huge benefit in London and, you know, dock workers came and spoke. I think that was probably in December. And then the Brit Awards is in February. And initially we didn't want to do it, but, you know, they said, oh, well, you have all this money, you can have this amazing stage show. And we got some friends, they were called Occupy the Streets, and they made films. So we used some of their films and made this big statement, changed the lyrics to the song, and they pre-record it, but it was all fine. And then, you know, we're at the Brit Awards and everybody's seated around these tables. You know, they seat like 12 people around a table and they all have this, it's like a huge bucket, you know, like, and it has all the champagne and chilled white wine in and ice water. And there's one by every table, you know, and you have a meal and everything, and there's bands playing. And it's getting close to the end of that, and Fleetwood Mac were playing because they were getting the lifetime achievement. And somebody, I think Paul, the bass player, said, oh, John Prescott sat over there. And he's like, you know, partway across the room. And his department, the Deputy Prime Minister, his department were responsible for dealing with the dock workers. And they were basically, you know, selling them down the river. And so it was kind of a spontaneous thing. We said, well, what can we do? You know, and we were all a bit drunk by this point. So, and I was the one who usually was most easy to convince of doing a dare. And it just came, okay, throw this water on him. And so, you know, I jumped up on the table, threw the water and said, this is for the dock workers. But meanwhile, Alice and Paul were behind him and they had one. They actually probably got him more wet than I did. But I was the focus. You know, I kind of ran away and got maybe 50 yards and the internal security got me and arrested me. And it became this huge thing, you know, because there was no major story in the news next day. So it was all over the news and the paparazzi were on my mum and dad's doorstep the next morning at 7:30 a.m.
Oh, sure.
And that was a huge, you know, how that part of the machine works, you know. So they basically lie about everything. I'm 5'7", and the papers describe me as a 6-foot skinhead. And they take a picture of my mum and dad's house and double its value. take a picture from an angle so it looks twice as big as it actually is. And they had this whole narrative that because my real name is Nigel, this whole narrative that I was a posh boy pretending to be an anarchist.
Oh, that's how they got you.
Okay. And it's just all bullshit, right. You know, but that's the regular currency of, you know, that lower end journalism. You can't even call it journalism.
Yeah, I'd hate to be well known in England. Jesus, it's terrible.
Yeah. Well, it only lasted for a few months for us.
Did you get charged with assault or anything like that for that?
No. So they arrested me and, you know, they had the head of security would be like the equivalent of an FBI kind of higher up guy.
Right, right.
The uniformed cops were guarding me and the head of security comes, right, I got to go talk to Miss Prescott to see what charges he wants to press. And then, like, I'm there for like an hour, and then he comes back and he's going, oh, well, he doesn't want to press charges, but we know who you are. So, you know, it basically couldn't do anything because it would have been more embarrassing for Prescott to press charges and go through some whole other media fanfare. So it just kind of fizzled out, really.
But good. That's good. That's good. I don't know if I'd have the marbles to do that in a public setting.
Did you sell any more records that week?
So it's funny. You know, the part of the narrative was in the press was, oh, it's just a publicity stunt. You know, we put statements out supporting the dock workers and some papers printed bits of them or
right.
Partly, you know, but mostly it was just, oh, yeah, they're just trying to sell records. But we actually didn't, you know, and it partly in the UK, they have this weird system where they basically just were selling the single. They weren't really that bothered about the album. So we'd sold nearly a million singles, but only like 70,000 albums. And it actually, the record sales went down after that.
I'm sure you made some more diehard fans.
Yeah. You know, we alienated, you know, signing to a major, we alienated part of our fan base. But over the years after that, you know, because we just carried on putting out albums and doing what we've always done, but we had a bit more money to be able to do it properly, you know. And, you know, especially because that the Brit Awards was right at the start of Tony Blair, you know, when there was still, like with the start of Obama, it was all hope and change, basically. Same message, but same bullshit. And as the years went on, especially with like the Iraq war and everything, you know, people just hated Blair by the end because he just sold out everything. And we'd said that consistently all along. So a lot of the people we alienated came back. I won't say all of them did, but, you know, they said, oh, I was wrong. I appreciate that you stood your ground and,
I saw this is kind of an interesting. I have younger kids, and you know I deal especially upcoming American election coming up. You know that's I'm sure going to be really really civil, and the discourse is going to be wonderful. So I saw you studied, you know, children's play at university for a couple years. And so in your estimation, you know, how much does like packaging and the way you deliver this information, like how much of a role or even a responsibility to the person delivering the information, like what can people use to deliver it more effectively?
See, yeah, so I think, you know, I studied children's play and I almost went into that field as a, probably what would have become an academic. But at that same point when I was finishing, you know, I went back to college when I was late 20s. And when I turned 30s, when Chumbawamba, we decided to go in 1992, like full-time professional. So I went in a different direction. But I've always maintained an interest in I see children's play as being total punk rock. You know, you have, I don't know how old your children are, but I have a 7-year-old I hang out with probably like once a week. And, you know, I have twins who are now 24, so I've been through it. And, you know, age 6 and 7, in terms of play, is what they call the golden age of children's imaginative, creative fantasy play, where they make up these whole worlds of, you know, in their heads and sometimes act them out with their friends or sometimes tell stories. And it's just an amazing time. And as we get older, we kind of distance ourselves from that kind of creativity, or a lot of us do. And we think, oh, I'm not an artist, I'm not a musician. But I think I tap into that energy as a artist. And I think punk rock did. It's just, you know, that I call it jumping off a couch. You know, when you're a kid, you jump off a sofa and pretend you're like jumping across a chasm and there's like dragons in the bottom or whatever. And you're trying to escape. And, you know, when you get on stage or write a song, that initial thing, where does it come from? You've just got to make that leap and, you know, you give voice to the thought or the sound or whatever it is. So, you know, in terms of presenting things to come back to your question, you know, an audience or a potential audience, I think the more kind of creative and inviting you can be, then there's just more potential for appealing to somebody. So, I mean, all my career as a performer or a musician, there's not always, but mostly there's been some politics. So how do you package that, if you like? If in the early days of Chumbawamba, it was just like, we call it shit in the mouth of the state, where it's just this total punk rock, angry voice. But we realized pretty quick we weren't really like that as people necessarily. And we like to have fun and we like to laugh. So we tried to incorporate humor and theater in the kind of Chumbawamba show. And I've always tried to carry on with that, you know, the theatrical play aspect of it. And it just breaks down, you know, if I'm just playing a show and people are eating dinner locally, I'll tell a joke or whatever, or you know, just to try and make it more open, you know, not such a narrow, it's just politics, I don't want to listen. You know, just to try and engage people.
Right.
The title of the album is Coctopus's Garden, which is a play on Octopus's Guardian, obviously, the Koch brothers who have done much to manipulate the political system in America. I won't be a sec. Hello? Okay, so can I call you back in like 20 minutes? I'm just in the middle of an interview, so, okay. Okay, yeah, thanks. Talk to you soon, bye. Okay, we're back.
Call your mom.
Yeah. the robots. Where
were we? The Koch brothers.
Yeah, we're
bastards.
On the fucking Koch brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so I read all the, you know, I'm writing a short essay, which will go with the record or on the website. You know, and the songs, some of them are playful, but the whole robot thing is, for me, it's I just love doing it. It's totally playful. And of course, there's all this debate about AI and everything going on at the moment. But
right.
My kind of thing is, you know, if we program AI to be fighting autonomous fighting machines, then maybe at some point they will turn on us. But if we programmed them to have empathy and, you know, it all depends on if... And so the story on the record is they're not programmed with capitalism, so they question it when they start becoming autonomous. And it's comedy, really, but it has a point to it. And
yeah.
I just love playing around with the voices. It's all from Google Translate. I just put the words in and space in gaps or alter the punctuation or stretch it out. And I spend hours doing it. I mean, it's insane, really, but I kind of... It fits with my kind of creative mode, if you like.
See, this is exactly what we were talking about before, you know? If you didn't sell a whole lot of tub thumping, then maybe I don't, you know, the world doesn't get fucking, you know, autonomous robots programmed without capitalism. Like, this is this is good.
Yeah.
This is important. I think one, you know, interesting play, like, I know some people, and, you know, myself included sometimes, who kind of emotionally can't handle being super aware of the world or the problems or the news, you know, like where it's a little overwhelming sometimes. And in order to keep a day-to-day relationship with it, there's something like emotionally you have to do. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of your records from, you know, from the last few years. And obviously you're still extremely on top of very specific things going on in the world and with politics. And it's obviously a major function in your life. So I'm curious, after all this time of being a hyper-aware person like that, is there any trick or advice to separating the two in the sense that you can understand all these things, you can understand the horrors and the evil and everything happening, but in your personal life, still like maintaining like hope and happiness? What's the trick there?
I don't know what the trick is. You know, I probably hinted at, had I not been in a band, I would probably be a historian or an academic or studying children's play. So part of my brain, you know, and I've tried to, I have written essays and had things published a little bit, but it's for me, it's just easier to take that and not necessarily simplify it, but put it into an artistic form, like in a song or a piece of theater. So on that side, I personally balance it by the joy of creating, even though I'm often talking about these awful things. The act of creating is what modifies it for me. And then, you know, I can leave it and go off and go hiking in the hills or whatever and not think about it. On a more general level, you know, I know people who don't want to engage in politics because it's so overwhelming. But there again, I have hope, you know, in recent years, I guess, you know, the women's marches, climate marches, Black Lives Matter, pro-Palestinian marches. There's so many people, especially younger people, who are, you know, my children, for instance, are outraged about what's going on in Palestine and traumatized as well in some way. You know, you can see it all on your phone.
Right.
But in that, I think there is some hope that, you know, there will come a point where either, I'm not saying there'll be like one major protest that'll change everything, but just the culmination of all these things that keep coming back. And, you know, politically, in terms of the American political system, it's been so fixed that it's difficult to envisage how we could ever change it. Like the Supreme Court, they're appointed for life and they're pro-conservative, pro-corporate. How can we possibly change that? But, you know, and the younger generations, and by that, I think it's now people under 45, are pretty much across both parties, pretty much progressive in outlook. You know, and teaching in a high school where we have the whole spectrum of progressive, left-wing, right-wing, Christian, you see that the children, even though they're, oh, I'm going to vote for Trump when I'm 18, or they're more progressive than the parents are in terms of being open to people of, you know, different races or different sexuality. They just, and it's just a huge, you know, it's just a, we see things moving forward, you know, like civil rights in the 60s, and but then there's still a racist kind of institutionalized system, but you can't put that back in the box. It's like the Republicans and abortion, they're trying to put it back in the box.
Right.
But, you know, on state ballots, they keep losing when abortion comes up.
It's out of the box.
Because Republican women, a lot of them vote in favor of women's choice. So there's like this, mm-hmm. you know, I see the huge cultural global shifts in people wanting more genuine freedom and rights for everyone versus the forces who are trying to keep it in the box. And they're the people who have the power, but they can't put it back in the box.
Yeah.
So I think there are times, you know, when people who don't want to get involved, a lot of them, or maybe their children, will get involved when it matters.
Yeah, when it matters, when they're forced to, right?
Yeah, and often it is that it's when they're forced to. But, I don't know, the Black Lives Matter. I mean, we haven't really had Palestinian demonstrations here in the little rural town, but we had Black Lives Matter, and the local police chief's wife organized a rival, Blue Lives Matter.
Yeah.
So we had
this
crazy demonstration where we were on opposite sides of the street and everybody knows each other.
Right.
You know, some people go across and have a chat and like, so I know we're a weird little kind of situation here compared to the bigger situation, but.
I mean, I think it's one of the real undeniable truths of one of the biggest things that's bad for us is disconnecting us. So, you know, I think this is a good, hopeful place to end, considering,
yeah.
you know, we're talking about some pretty grim shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciate all that time. That was really fun catching up with you and kind of getting to know you a little bit. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks. I appreciate you having me on the podcast and yeah.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Three, two, one.
Contact.
Welcome back.
Do, ch, do, 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 ch, do, ch.
Hey, so Stephen Smith, formerly of Going Off Track and Always in Our Hearts, texted me the other night that he was at the punk rock show. And yeah, saw you.
Yeah. Descendants, Circle Jerks, Adolescence.
Yeah.
Good gig.
So I saw them two nights later here in Brooklyn.
Where was the show in Brooklyn?
Is it this awesome, awesome new venue called the Brooklyn Paramount?
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
Fucking amazing.
Nice. Oh, fucking amazing.
It really is. It's a gorgeous space. It's insane. And it's got awesome, like, places to hang out. Like, it's like marble lounges and it's fucking sweet. Wow. I would recommend if you guys are playing in Brooklyn to try and play there.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, I really love the show. I didn't catch the Adolescents, I'm afraid. I saw a lot of Circle Jerks. Good yeah. performance. I noticed Joey C on drums, yeah. who I've seen play in Queens of the Stone Age. And who else did I see him play with? And the Bronx. Yeah. He's like a badass drummer. And I think he was fun to watch rip. Oh, Descendants yeah. were awesome where they played, you know, obviously they played everything I wanted to hear. And then there was like a little slop to it, but it was like the most fun slop I've ever heard.
Oh,
because they like could give a fuck. They were all just jamming with each other. Yeah. Like they have such a great vibe on stage. It's like, did you yeah. see, was Milo rocking his like studded water bottle holder?
So when he came out with that, I yeah. was mortified that he was like, that he had a colostomy bag or something.
Oh, no.
I was like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, especially after seeing like the first two acts, which everybody's in amazing shape. Like
sure.
everybody put yeah. on good shows, but like oh, yeah. you just, they're getting on. And I was like, and then when I realized that it was a water bottle, I didn't know whether to be actually a little more bummed than the colostomy bag.
You know, that's funny. My reaction was so different. A couple of people around me were like not that into it. And I was like, my first reaction was like, fuck, I wish I thought of that first. That's how great I thought his little water bottle holder was.
Because you're a drummer. It's all about utility first, man.
Like the holster and just having water right there all the time. I don't know. I thought it was fun. You know, I thought it was fun.
It was fine. It was fine.
Good rock show. Good punk show.
Fantastic.
Let me tell you, I got to tell you a funny story.
Okay.
So when I was in like junior year of high school, I joined a band in a town called Woodbridge, which was like at least 30 minutes from where I was living at the time. I didn't drive yet. I told the guys I wanted to be in their band, but the deal was you had to pick me up and drop me off. I have no ride. So I started doing this, but what ended up happening was we would practice Friday nights. We'd hang out, you know, yada, yada, and no one would want to drive me home. So by, you know, sometime in my junior year of high school, I was spending most weekends in Woodbridge, just crashing right. at people's couches and stuff until somebody felt like driving me home. And I used to sleep at my friend Rick Raspolich's house. He just had a nice, like, his room was down in the basement. He had, like, a full-length couch you could crash out on. Very nice guy. You know, it was family's house, not his, like, his own. And one morning, I'm lying there. And remember, when I was a little kid like this, when I was, like, 16, I was gigantic. But I was, like, so sweet. And I had this little baby face. And I hated messing with anyone. I was terrified, you know? And I wake up to this, Ricky, who's that big guy on the couch? Who's a big guy? Lady's afraid to walk by. The lady was the name of their family dog. He's like, Ricky, who's the big guy on the couch? Lady's afraid to walk by. And I'm sitting on the couch now, wide awake, but like paralyzed with fear because I'm just like, oh God, what's happening? This is terrifying. And then he's talking to his dad. He's like, you know, telling him to calm down or whatever. And all I hear next is, and what's up with this Chubba Wubba song? I get knocked down, Ricky.
What?
What? And I guess it was on the radio probably around that time. Because when that song came out, what, 96, 97? So that adds up. That adds up. And oh my God. So forever... Just as a funny ancillary to a very nice interview we did, because Dan Burt was an excellent person to talk to. Yeah. like that anytime, the first time if I see them on a video, if I look up a song or something, the first thing I always hear is, Ricky! Lady's afraid to walk by. Rest in peace, lady. This is a long time ago. But anyway, I thought this was a great interview. Oh, what about you?
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Just like, a wealth of knowledge from a time and like just that old school jump to the major and the,
yeah,
you know, and it's like a lot of people have a lot of opinions about stuff like this, but you know, I think the simple fact that like literally, and this isn't like a 3-piece band, this is an 8-piece band.
Yeah.
Like they wrote a song that connected with so many people for whatever reason that it basically supported 8 artistic lives afterwards. You know what I mean? And like,
well, and then like all their little ancillary, you know, projects when they were doing licensing deals, they were giving their money away.
That's right.
To other people.
Yeah. And all this like, and I don't know. I mean, I hate to ever sound like a trickle down economics kind of guy, you know, but you know, sometimes the little guy needs something to keep the engine going, you know what I'm saying? And like, this is a good example of that. I also really connected and empathized with that one part of the interview where he was talking about, you know, them sort of realizing like a lot of the lyrics and the messaging at the time was delivered in a super angry kind of visceral way like that. And they kind of stepped back at one point and went like, you know what? Like, we're not angry people.
Right.
So that's not the way like we should be presenting stuff. And there's kind of like a self-awareness with that that's really lovely. And I connected with because like I've always been super connected with the ethos of punk, what it actually stands for, like a collective idea of... you know, everybody starting on the same beginning line. You know, I believe right. in this like wholeheartedly, but I really don't like being mean. You know, well, I don't like fighting just because I'm big.
For you?
Knock somebody out if I have to. I don't enjoy it. It's nothing good.
That's why they invented emo.
You know, but no, see, this is your part of the problem. Archaic thinking, you know, like I should be able to be nice. Not talk about like my ex-girlfriend in songs, like talk about some real shit, but not right. have to be like some aggro dude about it because that's just not what I am.
Let's come back to the Descendants, dude.
Right.
Like what? The songs are about getting married and like...
Well, sort of, but even
girlfriends.
Like... Even, do you remember when that weird January 6th defendant was wearing a Descendants shirt? And for a second there, people are like, what is this, a fascist band? And, you know, you didn't have to go very deep in Descendants catalog to realize you're not dealing with a fascist band, you know, like, you know. But anyway.
He only liked the one song, Everything Sucks.
No, he was trying to reappropriate himself. That's called personal rebranding, what that fellow was doing. But... So I don't know. I kind of really connected with that too. Like, and it made me sort of appreciate the way they took their career too, because when you realize these people are as punk as it gets, like you can't fuck with their receipts. You know what I mean? They're literally like, you know, striking with coal miners in the early 80s and attached to Crass and Crass Records, like the really most punk stuff. But then you have like kind of the balls by the early 2000s to be writing these like, still songs with a lot of messaging, but in a dance format, in like a pop format, you know, like, I don't know. I think it's cool.
That's
I really
a smart
do.
Move.
I really
smart
do.
Move.
So I really appreciate Dan Burke coming on. It was a pleasure to talk to him. Really was.
Yeah.
And check out his new music. What kind of, where can you find him?
On Instagram, it's D Nobican, D no bacon. Sorry, but that's how it's spelled. Oh wait, no, that's Twitter.
That's
Instagram. Is his full name Danbert Nobacon, which is Nobican. Danbert Nobacon D-A-N-D-E-R.
I like how you just played both sides of the fence there.
Hey, man, want them to get the spelling right. But yeah, go there and check them out. And yeah, the new stuff is definitely worth checking out. And so is, you know, Tub Thumping.
Yeah. But hey, Brad.
Yo.
We have our Patreon too, if you want.
Patreon.com/goingofftrack. We just posted a good video of Benny giving a full recap of the latest tour, complete with pictures and a bonus video at the end.
Bonus video?
The ice bath in the dressing room.
Oh, yeah.
Say no more. Say no more. If you want to see it.
You want to see it. You want to see me in an ice bath post show.
Yeah.
Champagne poured all over me.
Yeah. Now, let's not exaggerate.
All right. Okay. But Brad. Yeah.
Go there and follow us at Going Off Track wherever you get your social media. And we'll be back next week with a very good guest.
Wunderbar, I would say.
Wunderbar.
All right. Everybody love everybody.